Hey, welcome to the right time. Now, check this out. A lot of you had asked if we could do a podcast episode that would do all the Right Time Book Club episodes together. So all our discussions of Friday Night Lights by Buzz Bissinger, we could have them where you could go back and listen to all of them at once if you wanted to get to the book late or anything like that. Well, guess what? We've got that for you, and it's right here. Ah, yes. It's time for the Right Time Book Club. Fosworth, is that a like adequate British accent? Weren't you barring over there or something?
I was, but I left before I was old enough to really hear or understand anything. I was on a military base anyway. American over there.
I didn't know we had military bases in England. That doesn't feel like someplace I could see people just walk around in camouflage.
Oh, we got them everywhere.
I mean, I know we do, but when you think about when people are like, yeah, I got stationed somewhere, it's normally not, you don't hear people like, oh, I was stationed in jolly old England.
Yeah, that's true. I feel like it's a lot of Japan, a lot of Germany. A lot of those places, but yeah. I don't know what the deal was. Maybe it's all a lie. Maybe everything has been a lie.
They just told you that as a phony birth certificate. You could never run for president.
I could be actually like 45. They just turn that birth certificate down like they do baseball players.
That is true. This is our man Dominic Fosbury. Check him out at The Undefeated. Also, The Morning Roast, Sunday mornings on ESPN Radio. And he is joining us for the Right Time Book Club, where we are reading Friday Night Lights this summer. We're doing four chapters every month, and then we have somebody on to talk about them. Dominique is kind enough to join us. And so, yes, I chose Friday Night Lights by Buzz Bissinger because I think it's just maybe as good a look at American life as anybody's going to find, using football kind of sort of as the prism. Now, had you read this before we got into this project?
No, I hadn't. And, I mean, I agree with you, and I appreciate you assigning me this book because I have never read it, in part because, like, my whole life has been a lot of football, and so I didn't really want to read a book about football, but you're right. I'm four chapters in. I read all the preface and all those things, and it's not about football. It's just like football is a landscape they're using, or he's using, to tell stories about America, frankly.
And part of what's interesting to me, and so we get into chapter one where he lays out the town of Odessa, Texas. So, you know, Friday Night Lights is set in Odessa, Texas. Odessa Permian High School is a big football deal in the state of Texas in general. This is a West Texas spot. It's an oil town. And so the booms and busts of the oil business very much affected how things went in the town. We talk about the way the integration, you know, the Civil Rights Act and everything else affected these things in the town. And part of what I thought was, like, for me, as a native Texan, well, I wasn't born there, but I grew up there. So, like, as a Texan, I understand, like, the cultural significance of football and what it means to these towns. But you, even as a football player, you're from a different part of the world. And I get the feeling that it wasn't quite as serious for you as it is for these people.
No. I mean, I think even though I was a football player, you know much more about it than me. And I found that chapter to be particularly enlightening for me because while I did play high school football, I played high school football in Baltimore County. Like, it is, we don't care the way that they care. And so I don't know if it was the preface or if it was chapter one, but I really appreciated how they laid out the history of the city because I think it gave me a good idea for the culture of a place like that. And it seemed like a lot of those themes were like the independence and I guess I'm not sure what the right word for is it, but it's just resilience is like the positive spin on what I'm actually thinking. But they're just independence, I guess, is the best word. That feels like it's ingrained in Texas culture and particularly in that city.
Yeah, West Texas in particular, because like the range, like open space is like the defining characteristic of Texas and like the individual liberty that comes from the fact that you don't really have to share space with people. You know, therefore people, that's the way they look at it. Like our man Terrence says that this was the setting, but it could be any town in America. And I say, yes, that's true. But there's a particularity though to the thing with Odessa because the booms and busts are about oil. Right. It was like what the price of oil could do to people. But the one thing that was constant was this football team. And so I was like, it's old Bill Withers line. The city ain't no bigger than the friendly people that you meet. And so for them, being a Permian Panthers is the most important thing there was.
Yeah. I mean, I think the oil thing just makes it condense. Like the booms and busts in American culture maybe take longer time to develop. But I think that to defend my man, that is kind of true that those booms and busts, they happen in Texas more quickly than they happen, or at least in this area, more quickly than they happen in the rest of America. But you can see those same themes playing out.
You're right. By the way, can you imagine being a high school football coach and people putting for sale sign in your yard?
I'm a high school football coach. I'm here for the kids.
Like, yes.
I don't need my job, my livelihood threatened.
Yo, man. They're not here for it. So that was chapter one. Chapter two was entitled The Watermelon Feed. And this is a very Texas thing, as you talk about there, that us against the world, like Gabe calls it like a frontier mentality, but that is very, very, very Texas. It is wild because I don't remember this happening, but Texas had a no pass, no play rule that if you did not pass all your classes, you could not play in the next grading period. And that was in part pushed by Ross Perot. And one of the examples that Ross Perot was using was Odessa, because he said they were so football crazy. And at that time had what was a crazy $5.6 million stadium. Man, we got people in Texas now building $100 million stadiums.
Yeah, the Ross Perot nugget was interesting because it spoke to how important football is to that society. Because Ross Perot, you would think that's their candidate. Like, he was an oil man. Yeah, that's their boy, you would think. But he said one slick thing on Nightline and they were done with him. He wouldn't even come to the city.
I want to make sure that our kids pass their classes.
How dare you? That's right. Blasphemy.
Right. They're like, no, you don't want to do that. That's no, but that was the thing though about high school. That was wild for me, man. These cats would always make it through football season, but they ain't all make it with us to graduation.
That's sad.
Yeah. I mean, that was the thing. They did not all make it with us through graduation, but all of that though is such a great setup though from Bissinger on, and part of what's so great about the way he writes this is that it's so thorough, but he's never talking over your head in any sort of way whatsoever. And he came into this as a complete outsider, to the culture, but it just speaks to the role that being a high school football player plays, like the thing with the pets, being there with you. And basically, like, if you made the team, girls are what you got. Like, it was in the contract.
Yeah, I mean, I that was one thing. So this whole time I'm reading the book, I'm trying my best to not be judgmental and like assume that these people are not bad actors, because the inherent sexism that exists in our culture, it seems to be like hyper in that place. And I guess the same thing could be said for the racism. But the whole time I'm thinking it's an undue amount of pressure on these kids. Like, they're carrying the weight of the entire city, it seems like. Doesn't quite qualify as a city, the whole town. And the whole time I'm thinking of it, it's like, what do they really get out of this? Like, some applause or whatever? And I guess that's where the pepettes come in, and the girls in general. Is like, there's a feeling that they are entitled to them, and they like belong to them to some degree if you make it to a contributor on the Permian football team.
It's pro football, right? It's just that we've reduced the scale, but for that area, this is pro football.
Yeah, I mean, I can't disagree with that, but it's different than pro football in many respects, in that it's so much worse for the players. Like,
yeah, because there's no check, right? The payoff.
Having been a pro football player, like, the reward is now, like, I work at ESPN because I want to. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's a real nice thing to have, and I don't take it for granted. The reward for them is like, they like have their pick of the high school girls for the fall, and then yes, they leave with no education.
Yes, that is exactly what I'd say. That is it. The reward for them, this is going to be the best time of your life.
That's so depressing.
Yes, that is the most depressing thing you could possibly imagine, but that's the reward. This is going to be the best time of your life. And when we talk about the depression of that, that gets us to chapter 3, which is the Boobie chapter. And, you know, Boobie Miles has become a pop culture icon, but it starts with this book where he's a story that I think is kind of decidedly 80s in the sense that he suffered this catastrophic knee injury when he was in high school. And in this day and time, they might be able to repair that and get him back. But for him, that was a wrap.
Yeah, that's... Like, I know of Boobie Miles, even though I didn't read Friday Night Lights until we started this, but I knew of Boobie Miles, to your point of it being a cultural touchstone to some point, but I didn't know all the details about him, his uncle kind of adopting him, LV Miles, and all the pressure that his uncle was putting on him, and the history of race. Like, I keep bringing it up. I'm sure we'll get to it at some point, but this, like, it hangs over the entire book and how race impacted LV and how it impacted Boobie and how they just generally didn't care about the kids, the black kids or the black adults, unless they had some contribution to that Permian football team.
And no, when Bissinger talks about this book, you know, and writing it, he says, you know, he talks about moving there and just being struck by the overtness of the racism, and that like the use of the N-word was just so casual and common, even in reference to somebody like Boobie, who they halfway said they love because of what he could do for them, comma, but right.
It's true of this entire book. There are things that happen in any of our societies or cultures that are just kind of relics, and we like keep them around because we're used to them. And to some degree, I don't want to say you don't know any better, but you're just so comfortable with it. And when an outsider comes in and really like makes you face how ridiculous it is, like, I think that's what their football culture comes down to. That's where like the overt racist language comes down to. It's like, it's always been like this, and no one's ever questioned, like, is this really right? And I wonder how they reacted, like when this book came out, like how they reacted to the rest of the world.
They were not pleased. They were not pleased at all. Like, they were not happy with Bissinger. They felt that Bissinger had basically betrayed them, that they let him in, and then he kind of went and took the side of the others after he'd been there for this whole year, you know, and doing all the work. But, you know, you talk about this with, you know, the no education part. The fact that so many people would say that they worried what would happen to Boobie Miles if he didn't play football, but gave him no preparation for what to do without football.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's... I mean, back to the point you were making there about Bissinger turning on them, it popped in my mind. Like, that is a book that only a white journalist could write. Like, probably yes. Only a white male journalist could write. Like, a black woman can't walk in that town and get the same access and get the same, real content. But, to your point about them not preparing Boobie Miles, like, yeah, that seems true, but it also is like, the responsibility is certainly on the society, but, to the point I was making before, like, that is life in Odessa. And maybe I'm going too far. Like, you've made fun of me before about, like, being too much of a, like, bleeding heart and trying to understand everybody's perspective. But, like, that is what life is there. And yeah. It's, like, weird of it feels almost unfair of me to look at them and say, no, but Boobie Miles, y'all supposed to change everything. You're supposed to see the light. Like, I'm sure there are things – not I'm sure. I can think of several things in my life or several times in my life where I mean, you use women, for example. I've thought about women in my life a different way than I did when I was mature. And I expect, I guess, yeah, that's not fair necessarily, because then they are mature. They are adults. So I'm trying to find a way to defend them. Think, and you really
I
do, can't.
I found the place where your heart can bleed, and this all makes sense. No, but really though, so we're talking about, why aren't you thinking about life with Boobie to get out of Odessa? And I think the point you're making is they ain't thinking about life of getting out of Odessa neither.
That's true. Nobody got them out of Odessa. No.
Like, that's not what they're thinking. They're like, yo, how much better does it get than this? Like, yeah, maybe you go play college football, but in the end, this is going to be the best days of your life. So like the movie Friday Night Lights, I think it was Tim McGraw that was playing that one kid's dad that was so hard on him, you know, while he was playing, because this was it. Like, this is being a Permian Panther, playing for Mojo was the highlight. And so for Boobie, they're like, they only got him there playing football for what he can do for them in the first place, to, you know, all the way down to the way the school district lines are drawn.
And they probably look at the other black kids and think that Boobie got it good. Cause there are plenty of other black kids who are less prepared, and probably white kids too, who are just as poorly prepared for the world as Boobie, but they don't at least Boobie get that one fall where he's the man. Like, that, I imagine that they look at it that way, that Boobie should feel lucky and fortunate that he's had these gifts.
Especially with the irony of it, right? Because that the hallmark of that team was always that they were smaller and not as athletic as the other teams that they would play, but they played so hard and tough, you know, and it was striking that they had all the white guys on the team, you know, post-integration in Texas, they could still compete the way they did. But in the end, they felt like to win, they still needed a Boobie Miles. And so they had to put up with it.
They had to cross into the town to get the athletes that they needed. Yeah, I don't know. I also found, like, you're talking about how they kind of revel in the personality of the team, and they believe that kind of never stay die, that fight undersized thing is something that resonates with the whole town. Like, that did strike a chord in me, and something that I have experienced, where you are in a mindset, like, you're teetering on sanity, frankly, like on the edge of being a normal person in order to get to where you need to get to play in a football game. And I feel like I've had teammates who stayed in that place all the time, and I didn't understand that. And through the course of my college and professional career, like, it was a slow deterioration of that mindset and coming to a more normal mindset, which is part of the reason, like, it made it harder to continue to play. And, like, when I was in high school, you're young and you're kind of, you feel invincible, you're kind of stupid. It's pretty easy to, like, convince yourself that the team across town, like, you actually hate them. You actually want to kill them. Like, I can remember feeling that about people, and I didn't think it was abnormal at the time, but it seems like it's probably an exclusively short of war. Like, it is a football phenomenon, and it is pervasive, particularly in Texas.
Yeah, also, man, you're fighting for, I mean, it is hyperbolic to say that football players are fighting for their lives, but not really, right? Like, yo, that dude over there is not trying to kill me, but he is willing to hit me hard enough to kill me.
I mean, it's the only, I mean, short of combat sports, it's the only sport where, like, part of the game is to try to hurt people. Like, it's this new safer NFL is a new thing that doesn't really bleed into the culture the way the game is played, even in NFL. Like the idea of making somebody pay for going over the middle, or the idea of, okay, you're going to tackle a guy. They may have got the first down, but we're going to make him feel it. Like, that's part of the game. Part of the game is to inflict pain on someone else. And like, that's, there's no other sport. Like, you can play a basketball game and you could be the best team in the league, in any league, and not necessarily hurt anybody. Football, you can't be good if you're not hurting people.
And you need people to be afraid that they might get hurt. Like, that's a significant part of the calculus.
Yeah, absolutely. And to get your, and back to the point I was making, like, to get your mind to that place, like, that's a weird thing. So, like, I suspect that most people have been in a fight, and you know the rage that you feel when you're in a fight. You're not thinking clearly, and you're just really trying to hurt somebody. Like, to get your mind, that's not a healthy place to be on a regular basis. And they were asking those kids to be there to the point where you could lose a testicle and be like, nah, I'm gonna go ahead and keep playing. Like, that happened in the book.
Now, in chapter four, we get to some other things there. One is, you know, and this to me, like, looking back at Booby, is like the saddest part is having read this book as an adult, which is he thinks it's different for him because he's Booby Miles. He doesn't realize that everybody else is getting treated worse.
Yeah, that's sad, but true. It's, I mean, that's a, again, to tie it back to like my experience, like that's the experience of the NFL quarterback. Like as a president of the union, like I've had to deal with or work with lots of players to accomplish lots of things. And it's always the quarterbacks that think that, nah, they're a little bit better than the rest of us until they figure out, nope. Like, I remember for Drew Brees, it was when he hurt his shoulder. He's like, oh, they don't really care about me. Peyton Manning was when, he had his back hurt and they were trying to get rid of him. He's like, oh, yeah, they don't really mess with me. And I think the same thing is true for Booby, in that he kind of thinks he's special, but he also thinks he deserves to be treated even better.
Yep. As a black dude in Odessa.
Yeah. I'm not sure what it does for the psychology of the black people in Odessa, because the part of the idea that they're able to use the N-word so willy-nilly and they treat black people in a certain way, like, not that, it's not that full equality is realized in any state of America in the 80s or even now for that matter, but the idea that the black people didn't even seem to be, or at least Bissinger didn't write about them looking to affect for some sort of change. Like, that is also a little bit like mind blowing. Like, the culture of the place is most of the black people are like, yeah, this is life in Odessa.
Yeah. And they drew the lines. Basically, you're only there, hopefully, because you'll be good at football. Otherwise, we have no use for you.
I mean, it seems like a sloppier attempt for a lot of the other things that were happening in America, because you feel like there's something connivingly brilliant about, like, depriving black people of home loans. Like, that is a sneaky way to affect the society in the way that you wanted to. But it seems like in Odessa, they weren't even that smart. They just like, look, you black, I don't mess with you. You live over there. And the black people were kind of like, all right, that's what we do.
Like, what are we going to do about it? How would fix this?
That's
fair. Fix what I would do. Buy a house cash? No. We're going to stay over here. Now, another part of this, and I'm curious, you know, you as someone who played, you know, high level sports for a very long time, Christina makes a point about the dude Mike in the book and how he didn't even get satisfaction out of hitting home runs in baseball. Right. Like, he was just doing this to please his parents. Like, that to me is one of the sadder things about this, is it doesn't even sound like these kids are necessarily having a good time.
Yeah, I think was it the quarterback, Winchell, right? Who just seemed to be racked by, like, unimaginable stress. Like, that's not fun. That's not a fun way to go through. I remember my junior and senior year in high school. Like, it was really fun time. Like, I was chilling, playing against some random Baltimore County teams that weren't really that good. If we lost, like, I was mad, but I was over it by the time Monday came around. But, like, these guys, no, like, this is something that there are games and plays, mistakes that I've made playing that sit with me for my entire life. And sometimes I think about them and they make me angry. Those were in the NFL. Like, I can't remember much about my high school career. Like, I didn't care about those games that much. And the idea that I'm walking around, or these kids are walking around, frankly, with, seems like feeling more pressure than I felt when I was playing professionally. Like, that just seems terrible for a young man to have to deal with. But I guess, at the end of the day, they feel like the rewards are worth it.
But also keep in mind, man, this book is 30 years old. And so in a lot of ways, it feels like this foreshadows just what like high school sports have become across the board. Like I think about it, like our network, we broadcast high school basketball games because we do it because there'll be like a one or two stars in there. But I'm thinking, yo, there's 10 dudes up there that should never be dealing with the scrutiny of playing on television. You know what I mean? Like they're just not that good. That's not what these games are supposed to be.
And I mean, you think about Odessa and they didn't have a bunch of games on national television, but their whole world, like it's almost worse. Like being a football player in the NFL, like if I had a bad game, the whole, like all the football fans were upset and gave me a hard time, but I could go other places in my life and not experience that. Like in the '80s in Odessa, Texas, like their entire world cared and knew about how they perform. Like that's, which is why I feel like in some ways you could argue that it is tougher than being, at least emotionally, tougher than being in the NFL because I'm a grown man who's getting paid well. If I'm having a tough time in Denver, let's say when I was playing there, I could go to Vegas or I could go somewhere, a part of the city where people didn't care about football. That world didn't exist for them. Like the world that they knew was Odessa, Texas. And if things didn't go well, everybody knew. I imagine you couldn't go to the grocery store without knowing that people were talking bad about you before you walked in.
Or you could call your parents, right? Like, I feel like these kids can't even call their parents because their parents want that dub. Their parents want the dub like everybody else wants the dub because they are of this. And that's rough.
I looked it up before we started. Only 6 players have made it to the NFL. And I think Roy Williams, the receiver, is the only one who, like, actually played a substantial amount of time. So like the way that people explain away the inequities in college sports is often like, oh, but they get a chance to go pro. Like, nah, they're not really, nobody's really going pro out of Odessa. Like this is where it begins and ends. And it feels like the funny thing here is it feels like reading the book, the players know that, which wasn't true, weirdly enough, of my Baltimore County football experience. Like there were a few guys who were not getting D3 offers, but was like, yeah, when I'm in the NFL, like those kids know, like, nah, this is it. Probably because they see it all the time. Like they remember when they were, I guess, 10, 11, 12, and they saw the big football star who just so happens to still be down the street sweeping up at a restaurant or something.
Yeah, man, I saw those and I went back for high school reunion, man, and that was rough. Like it really was. Tough. Like I was listening to a guy and he was talking to me and he was just like, yo, these people in this town, you know, they had all the love for me when I was playing football, but now I'm around here and they can't do nothing for me. And that was so wild to think of for me because, yo, I graduated from high school 21 years ago. Like I like to still be thinking about that, but I can't imagine how they treated him when he was on top.
That's tough. So like we're being completely transparent, like I retired from the NFL and it was my choice, frankly. Like I could have probably played a little longer and I went on to like fancy schools and like I was planning for my transition the whole time and I thought like I was prepared for it. But like it still was difficult to go through that transition. And like I have all the benefits that you could think of, like a beautiful wife, family, and like some financial security. And going through that felt odd for me in my 30s. Like, go through that at 18 with no real support system to think of, no real resources to think of, and no real opportunity. It's not like you can go back to high school and do it better the second time so that you can get into college.
Right.
Like, that just has to be, I can't imagine the psychological toll and how difficult going through that is. And it's not something that many people experience. So it's not like you can call somebody and be like, hey, let's talk about how we're going to work through this. All the people that they probably look at are people who tried to work through it and failed. It seems like maybe it's grim the way I'm talking about it, but it's depressing.
No, but this is, I mean, it's a thing that James Baldwin talked about in The Fire Next Time. It's like the idea of having to hustle, that when people see you, they know who you are, what your thing is at the very least. And what these guys' thing will be is that they played for this football team. But it's not even that they play for it now. It's like, this is the thing. Hopefully you'll take this with you because it gets no better for you in Odessa.
What's Odessa like now? Like there's, I Googled the school and the football team came up, but was there any introspection? Like I don't expect that you went down there and checked it out, but maybe you've read articles over the years. Introspection and improve.
I don't think they looked at business and was like, yo, we had to change what we was doing. They was like, yo, man, why you out here snitching? that's it. Why you right here snitching? But hey, man, that is Dominique Foxworth. Check him out on the Morning Roast, 9 to 12 Eastern on Sunday mornings on ESPN Radio. Check him out at theundefeated.com. And also for the book club, we're going to do this every month. So July 31st will be the next installment. Read chapters 5 through 8 to catch up with us for what we're going to be doing on July 31st. My man, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it too, man. Thanks for having me. And I'm actively rooting against whoever the next person is. I'm determined to be a better guest.
Hey, man, I'll let you know how the competition goes. We'll maybe take some votes.
All right. I'm in.
Ah, yes. The Right Time Book Club. We are reading a book, by the way, that has like none of that pretense to it. Reading Friday Night Lights by Buzz Bissinger, the story of the Odessa Permian Panthers. And joining me to talk about this book is a man who has spent a great deal of time in West Texas. You can find him as the co-host of High Noon. His name is Pablo Torre. And just in case you were curious, he's never done to basketball before.
Not yet.
Not on a 10-foot goal.
Not yet. I'm going to get those shoes that they put in the back of those magazines we had when we were younger.
You're going to get yourself right.
I'm going to get those moon shoes. And I'm going to come in and I'm going to show you a videotape of me throwing one down. And then I will laugh. But until then, you are correct.
Yep. Just making sure that you have an understanding of this. Now, you had not read Friday Night Lights before this undertaking.
No, I have never dunked and I had never read this book. It is a cultural blind spot for me. The most I've gotten from Friday Night Lights is listening to Explosions in the Sky, which I understand was the theme song for the TV show. But the book has been foreign territory till now.
But I find interesting, yes, the book is the cultural blind spot, but in reading this, because you're a New Yorker, and that is part of what I think is interesting about this, because to me, the themes of the book are very, very familiar, but
yes.
You are of a slightly different world.
Yes, no, there is a bunch here that struck me as, this is the place that we refer to when we talk about the caricature in some ways of West Texas, yeah.
Yeah, but not even West, let's be fair, the caricature of West Texas doesn't have people in it. That is West is who, boy, they're different. They're over there. Like that's a part of Texas that I'd have no like reason or thing to go to. But the thing I relate to, I mean, just the notion of the cultural significance of high school football. Like it's a thing.
I did not have a football team in my high school. So this is all make believe in a way that I've come to, I've come to really be fascinated by.
Yeah, but there's a social hierarchy at your school based on activities though, right?
Oh yeah, it was the debate team and I was, you're right, the captain of the GD debate team.
But that was the squad.
That was the squad.
Like, I'm curious at the dynamic of how that goes though, because it was also all boys,
all
right?
All boys and so much of this, obviously, in Friday Night Lights at Permian is through the lens of, yeah, these kids are adults. They are treated like adults, but at the same time are deeply and severely and problematically infantilized at other times. Yeah. So that's another dynamic to it.
Yeah, but I think part of why I think that this is a book that people need to read is I think it is one of the greatest looks at race in the late 20th century of the United States that is disguised as a book about football. Football seems to kind of be really secondary. All of this centers and stems around race, all the way down to the way they draw the lines to decide who gets to play at the school.
Crazy.
And who gets zoned in. Like, what was your thought in reading that when you saw that the desegregation of these schools really had a lot to do with how could we make our football teams better?
It made so much sense, obviously, once you spell it out, that the entire reason anyone is urged to desegregate is for the personal profit. And personal profit is measured most primarily in this part of the world in football. But just the dateline, Bo, right? 1982.
Yes.
I mean, it's just a good reminder that we're not far away from when this was segregated.
Yes.
It's wild.
Well, but except the problem is now they figured out how to do it without it being done exactly that way. But you're right. 1982. Look, there's this little town in Texas closer to my way called Vider. Vider's in East Texas between Port Arthur and the state line. I don't know exactly where it is. Yo, man, they had a fight to desegregate the projects in Vider in the 90s. In the 90s. Like, this idea of, you know, 1965 is not quite the date that people think it is when it comes to the notion of integration. Because after that, it was all kinds of fights that we had to have, you know, in order to get this. But part of what I think was interesting, and the people said this, that there was the black high school there, and their fear was with integration, when integration came, their high school would go away. And that's exactly what happened.
Yep. Ector.
Yes.
Ector. And yeah, 90% minorities and yeah, Mexicans and blacks. And that's the other ingredient in all of this that the book, this part of the book explores is, yeah, black people, real useful to football. Mexicans, less useful.
Yes. Therefore, useful for working at things.
Yeah, they did not. I mean, so insofar as there was this pecking order, football clearly was this thing that could selectively and temporarily elevate someone like Booby Miles.
Yes.
And of course, once they decide that you're no longer useful, we enter something that we are quite familiar with, which is the disposability of the athlete, which we still obviously deal with very much at the highest levels of pro football today.
Now, were you jarred by the widespread use of the N-word in Odessa?
I was. I remember on our show on High Noon, you had mentioned, I forget what the context was, but where you were, this place in Atlanta, some restaurant that, you know, the N-word was still being said. And I was like, oh, that's probably figurative. And then you go and you read this and just how completely, completely matter of fact it was. Again, it's one of those things. 1982, not that far back. The N-word being this commonly accepted.
And that's like 88. Like when we start talking about this in the current time of that book, you know, like that's like 88. And so the thing though that I think is interesting about that and where I think is useful in this book. Now, Bissinger himself was a bit thrown off. I think he was living in Philadelphia at the time and he was a bit thrown off. And I do believe that there are some segments of perhaps more genteel society where this doesn't happen so much, but people act so mortified at the idea that a white person said the N-word like it's rare.
Well, and the book establishes that the meaning, the particular meaning of the N-word as juxtaposed against black as a descriptor, that whether you were an N-word or whether you were black was A, decided by the white person who happened to be around at the time, but B, that it spoke to a behavior, a sense of self that was lower or higher depended on how you comported yourself in whatever way made all of these other people uncomfortable.
Yeah, and it's really hard to win at that one. And you know what that would make me think of? Because I went to school in a little town with like 1,500 people. And I've always said that I personally felt overwhelmingly like I was treated well in that town and by most people. Like I don't have negative impressions of it. You kind of got to wonder sometimes if that's because they had decided that I was the mythical black person as opposed to the rest of these. See, that's another level of this that I don't think this book really gets to a good place of touching on. It's like, for what it's like if you exist in this experience and you recognize, oh, it's not that you think we cool, you just rock with me.
Yeah, specifically you.
Right.
High achieving, well spoken you.
Only you, by the way.
To the exclusion of the rest.
The exclusion of everybody else. Now, kind of on this topic, at JCH04 said a big thing that got him was he felt as though the folks in Odessa were basically minimizing those other people and their struggles and like blaming them for their own oppression, saying they're complicit in the situation they're in. And one thing I do find that this touches on that gets lost is the dangers and what happens with high levels of segregation. And so the argument that they make for people on the business end of segregation is, well, you had your chance to do your stuff and look at what it was. As though everybody's playing like we get the pie 50-50 and then split it from there.
Right. And when we get to, skipping ahead briefly, but when you get to the Odessa versus Permian dynamic, where the one school is now full of Mexicans in Chapter 8, yeah, the reputation of that school is down in the dumps because everyone is assuming that, yeah, the Mexicans basically came in and ruined this for us.
Yeah, and also because we're in Chapter 5, we talk about this. Did you also pick up on the way that any black person that got any level of political power somehow magically turned out to be responsible for a crime?
It was startling. And I thought Bissinger actually presented this as fairly as he could while also being matter of fact about it, insofar as he sort of told us up front, like, here are the characters. But at the same time, it reminded me of something that I think about today with like Kaepernick stuff, right? Which is, the message is so much less fun to discuss at the moment in time than the messenger. Like, these people, their messages were clearly on the right side of history. But the idea that you could pick at someone and say, well, you did this, and therefore not only is your status as messenger invalidated, but the message therefore is invalidated, speaks to, yeah, how little interest people had in the message to begin with.
Yeah, well, I mean, the other part of it is, and this is like the dilemma, is if people start with an initial negative presumption of you based on race, then anything that you ever do wrong then becomes confirmation bias, and then it goes from there. Like,
yes,
there's always a countdown to some time equals capital T, mm-hmm. at which point you are going to ruin this.
Yeah, but I mean, but the stories are crazy. Yeah, Lenita Atkins, one of the Democrats in the city. And then you get to Lawrence Hurd, who's like in jail when Bissinger interviews him. It speaks to how long it took for people to realize that there was some real systemic stuff mm-hmm. that needed to change. When you could just point to the messenger, it's easy to keep brushing it aside.
Yeah, also I thought it was funny, the dude that got locked up for arson conspiracy, he says it was political setup, and I feel like their response to that was, yep, got you. How about that?
That was the end of that.
Yeah, we set you up and you got that. Now, we went to chapter 6, the ambivalence of Ivory, and that was an interesting one with this running back, Ivory Christian, who, you know, liked football, but he didn't find the game to be that Christian. Like, what'd you think of that?
Look, I did go to a Catholic school. I understand the religiosity element of all of this. But it did make me wonder how hard it must be because we learn about all the other stuff his peers are up to. Like, he is refusing the privilege afforded to him as a black player, right? Like, you get...
And by privilege, we're basically talking about white women.
Correct. No, you get to taste from the thing that the rest of you cannot taste. And he's like, nah, not for me. Which is fascinating. And I wonder how much of that figured into his faith. But the other thing, of course, is the fact that we do meet Odell Beckham Sr.
Yes.
And believe you me, I immediately Wikipedia'd Odell Beckham just to make sure that this was the same one.
Because there could be, I applaud your attention to detail to hear about this particular Odell Beckham and ask, I wonder if his son is Odell Beckham of the Giants.
Well, I assume there are other Odells and I assume there are other Beckhams. I just wasn't sure how many Odell Beckhams there were.
Yeah, and Brewtown Andy makes the point. It seems Odell ain't fall too far from the tree.
Oh, no, he was like a star.
Yeah.
Yes,
like,
yes.
Everything they're saying about young Odell, they seem to say about old Odell, except old Odell was in Marshall, Texas.
Oh, and I do recommend, by the way, Googling Odell Beckham Sr. just to see what he's up to. Like, he pops up on Instagram. He's a character. He's commenting on stuff.
You went rabbit hole on this, didn't you?
I did. And you know what? The new dude that Odell Beckham Jr. is... Yeah, behind every new dude is an old dude.
Who was a new dude of his day.
Who was a new dude at the time.
Right, so tells me I need to go back and look that up. Like, Odell Beckham Sr. probably out here dressed like one of the dudes in the time going to the club. Out here looking like Shalimar. But no, that's what it is. Also, what did you think about the idea that these kids were on a private jet?
That, the book is so much grounded in the hardscrabble, the dust, the desert. And then you're like, oh, okay, no, they have a private jet as well. I mean, it does tell you, what are the priorities?
But you know what, though? This is also part of why I understand why people in that town really cashed in on the glory of being on that team. Because, hey, look, man, let's be real about this. I make a lot of money, right? You make a lot of money.
Hmm?
You been on a private jet?
Not my own. But as a journalist, I was on a private jet with Canelo Alvarez on a boxing
Yeah,
thing.
But as a journalist, I mean, just
oh no,
like,
yeah, I'm not contributing
yeah,
not to
even,
the payment
right,
of jet,
right? Not even contributing to the payment of jet, or just being around the people that's going to get you on a private jet. Like, you're not there. These dudes have been on private jets. There's somebody right now working at an HVAC shop in Odessa, and he's telling me about the private jet. So yeah, I see how it is. They might cash in because they like one thing about this book in this town. They're intimately acquainted with the idea that your life will never get better than this.
Right.
They're not even like this, and I think it's another thing that's lost in this story. They're not even trying to send people to the league here.
Well, that's the thing. At one point, Bissinger runs over the numbers, and you realize that there is a more real and important reward that comes with being a big-time football player in this town. The reward is now.
Yes.
It's now. This is it. Enjoy it. Because afterwards, yeah, you're not going to go to the league. You're not going to play in college unless you're, yeah, an Odell Beckham Sr. type player. And yeah, you'll probably get hurt and be disposed of as soon as that happens.
Yeah, they're operating like the math problem they're looking at is different, because we often chastise people for making too heavy an investment in the athletics for their kids because the likelihood of making the pros is so small. And they're looking at it as the likelihood of you going to the pros is so small. Therefore, you absolutely should invest right now.
I mean, they have in this school a class of female students whose job it is, literal job, is to like bake cookies, bring them handwritten signs of support, like a personalized cheerleader.
Yes.
I mean, that is futile. That is beyond a reward. It's like being, having a royal servant.
Yeah. And look, we're in chapter 7 now when we talk about this. And I mean, the ways that the girls at school are viewed relative to the football players is insane.
Yeah, it's total. I mean, insofar as objectification can be made colorful and clear, this chapter is where that is established.
I mean, just every single, like all of it, even like with the teachers, right? The question about whether the teachers are prioritizing their actual, you know, what's being priority. The teachers think that the kids don't care because they care too much about football. But I'm like, damn, but so many of them on the football team.
I did wonder about. There's a passage where a teacher wonders whether the kids these days, something has changed, whether it's something different, because back when, however, a decade before, she was saying that it didn't seem to be this hard to reach the students in the 80s. And that did seem like maybe a cyclical kind of concern, because I do feel like teachers today are saying that ever more given the internet and such.
And they low-key blame black people.
Well, yeah, there's also that.
Right. Like the SAT, also that. The SAT scores go down. Well, you know, they low-key kill black people. That would have been bad. Sorry. But I didn't mean to say that.
Another quick note. Yeah, the football program had two computers. The English department had one.
Yes. Yes.
Like, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Yep. The writing is on the wall when it comes to, why a school exists when your computers are more heavily invested in the athletics department.
Yeah, and at Ms. Chris Holmes made that exact point about that, said it conditioned low expectations. I would just also like to point out, by the way, because this is one of my pet causes, you know, people very frequently like to make this argument that black people hate education and all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. But this young lady, Julie Gardner, who is being chastised for being smart while at her school, I don't think it was the brown people that were getting on her about that one.
Statistically speaking, that would not be the case.
Yeah, I don't believe that is where they are. Now, this is a quote from a board member said, if we prepared our kids academically as we prepare them for winning state championships, there is no telling where we would be right now. And she's kind of right.
Well, if you truly care about something,
yes.
Like the thing, right. So one of the things I was thinking about while reading this book was, what's actually special about this place? Like, how much of this is Buzz Bissinger picking a subject that is vivid and useful, and how much of it is him finding the place that cares the most about something? And I don't know if there are other places that can clearly argue that they care more, but once you establish that this is how you define your entire identity, not just as a school, but as a school district, as a city, as a state, yeah, no, I believe you. If you cared as much about anything like you do about this, great things, I imagine, would follow. Yeah.
The only thing, though, is, of course, there are all kinds of other issues that didn't come up. Like, everybody's just like, we just poured all our money into schools, everything would be okay. And it's like, okay, well, like, kinda, sorta, that's not exactly how these things manage to go. But, again, these are things that they say are black people problems, right?
Yes.
Like, this is the devalue of education right here. This is prioritizing athletics over education. This is something that anybody in this society is capable of, is my point. That people have all kinds of things that they take a certain measure of pride in, and they'll do it through schools at the expense of actual education. But I would say there's no difference between what they're doing here. Now, granted, it's high school, so we feel like the stakes are higher. But that's no different than what they're doing to people with college athletics.
Yep.
This is what you're here for.
The other thing that was interesting about that dynamic was the school's reputation before desegregation was as like a team of Wes Welkers, basically.
Yes.
It was the White Grinders.
Yes.
And what a testament to the character of the White Grinder that they were that good.
Yes.
But then collectively everyone admitted, vis-a-vis desegregation, Yeah, we're going to want to get some athletes. We loved ourselves and that image of self, but we also want to, beat Odell Beckham
Jr. But generally, we don't want any more than we have to have because we like being the Grinders.
Yes, so they want to have both. They want to be both.
We want to be the Grinders, but we don't want to be losers. That in the end, but that's how college football integration took place before it got to be where it is now, where the competitive stakes are too high. Mm-hmm. Basically, the issue was not that you need black people. It is that you cannot afford to turn away anybody that might be good. Right? Like the stakes are too high for you to turn away qualified applicants in the name of aesthetics and your ego.
Right. The idea of, oh, you're a Florida person or you're an Auburn person. How many stars do you have?
Yeah. Just go whatever it takes, right? No matter what it is, you just can't be out here. Like the reason why some schools have knuckleheads year after year because those are the schools that can't afford to whittle down the population. They got to take good however good comes. And sometimes good comes to them because good can't go nowhere else.
Right.
Right. But that's how it goes. And it's the same thing here. It's not even necessarily black people are just so fast. No, you can't be turning down fast people because they're black. That's it.
Yep. No, it's stumbling backwards into the veneer of equality.
Yes. Now we get to chapter 8, where it's the Odessa and Permian rivalry. And remember, there were three high schools before, right? Odessa, Permian, and Ector. And Ector was a minority school, and that one wound up shutting down. And so Odessa basically became the minority school with just enough pockets carved out for Permian to get themselves some football players.
Yes.
And then they played against each other. And I thought it was interesting the way that Bissinger talked about Permian and beating Odessa as how it had to feel as like the white school. And you are beating your lesser, browner counterpart.
Right. And the only solution proposed ended up being, well, what if we just combine schools and consolidate? And that would evade the entire dilemma, which, of course, was highly problematic for the winners. Like, why do we need to become more Hispanic? Right. That's your issue.
Right. They're like, no, we're over here good at football, doing our thing. Like, what? That I had not thought about it quite in that way, but like, what do we get out of this?
Yeah. No, we like being on top. Don't, to quote Kevin Durant, don't worry what goes on at the top of things.
Yeah, you're right. They're like, look, we can't beat you guys at football, so how about we become a part of your school? Sorry, senor. That's not what we want. Like, that's absolutely how they are viewing this.
Yes. The idea that race is, I mean, you read these chapters specifically, and if you thought that you could talk about football in Texas without talking about race, I have no idea how you would try to do that.
Oh, no, there's no chance. There's zero chance at all that you could do this. And also, while I'm thinking about it, Gabe made this point, and I thought that it was a very good one. They're shutting a school down because the athletics aren't good? They're not shutting the athletics down. They want to shut down the whole damn school.
Right. Your utility is how good you can make people feel as a football team.
But all politics are local, man. And see, and that's the thing about Texas, I think, in particular, that gets lost when talking about high school football is how spread out Texas is. Texas has 254 counties. 254, right. But a lot of these places are also not close to anything. Like you and I were talking a little earlier today about the idea of like your local football team or whatever. The local football team here is the high school.
Right.
Like that's how that works. And like that's their franchise. That's their college. That's what all of that is. That's what the local football team is. And so everything about their self-image, like I learned a lot about the sports that we cover really came from this book and the understanding of the role that identity plays in these local sports and how it's not just about the games. It's about what the games are ultimately saying about you yourself, like what it projects to the rest of the world about what kind of person you are. And I'd never really thought of it in that way, that it was that important on that very, very local, personal and human level.
Well, it seems that Odessa has a couple of things going for it. One of them is football. The other is oil, and the oil comes and goes.
Yes.
And if the oil comes and goes, how consistently can you feel good about yourself?
Well, that's the other part, too. The co-star of this story is oil. It's the ups and downs of the oil prices. And so much that happened in Odessa, because their times, they were living fat.
Right. And by the way, like, it answers the question of why is anyone living here?
Oil.
Oil. Because there's money in the ground that randomly and unpredictably pops up. Makes sense.
Right. And when it goes, everything is great. And when it's not, man, they want that football team to be good.
When it's not, you better be making me feel good about myself.
You better win. You imagine that pressure as a child, like as a teenager.
It's too much. It's too much. It's unhealthy. And that's, I don't know how all of these stories end. We've been introduced to so many of these characters now, these players, but everything feels like it's tinged with sadness. Like none of this feels sustainable.
No. No, there's not a happy person in this book that I can think of.
Yeah, I haven't met him yet.
There's not a, wait till you get to the end. Some of the stuff at the end is just gonna hit you like, oh damn.
Like, I know a kid goes to Harvard and stuff. I hope that, like, goes well. But that was also in the context of his girlfriend telling him, I can date you because Hispanics are almost white.
Yeah, it kind of depends.
Certainly is a case-by-case scenario. But for Brian Chavez, he seemed to be on the right side of the pigmentation, Mason Dixon.
There he is. That is my man Pablo Torre with our second installment of the Right Time Book Club. That was chapters 5 through 8. Ah, yes, our nice erudite music to lead into the Right Time Book Club. Feel like I should be sitting here, like, swirling around some cognac. Chad Johnson's looking through the window while we do this, by the way. And he just gonna keep all standing there. Let's go. All right. Anyway, that's an interesting transition here. We've been reading Friday Night Lights for the Right Time Book Club. We are now to chapters 9 through 12 on the book. And to join us now from ESPN the magazine, his name is Howard Bryant. Now, Howard, before we get to the book, I want to ask you, since the timing is here and you've done a lot of work on this topic, what do you think about Nike and this Kaepernick deal?
Get a lot of thoughts on that. I think maybe just first I'm thinking I'm going to have to play this out. I want to play this out. I'm concerned, obviously. I'm happy for Colin because I think that this is something that should have been overdue. Obviously, there's layers on top of layers. For example, where have you been, Nike, since he was already in your employ? There was that. I think there's also a fear, obviously, that you've got one corporation, the NFL, selling patriotism to its fan base, and now you've got Nike selling protest to its people that supported Colin. So the divide is still there. Let's see what happens with it, but I think the thing that I'm most concerned about is I don't like the idea of protest being commodified necessarily, especially if there's going to be some resistance or rebellion sneaker coming out of this at $175 a pop.
Yeah, like I am curious exactly what exactly Nike sees in this, because there's obvious things there certainly, and also apparently their numbers say that they can make some measure of money off of this, but I'm wondering what exactly it becomes.
Well, absolutely. What is it going to become? And I think that people have been asking for this. I mean, I remember when Cap first took a knee and when there was the blackballing in 2017, there were people saying, hey, you know, NFL, you know, there are people who support this guy too. So Nike is obviously looking at that unappreciated opportunity right there. But the thing that gets me most is can you, as a corporation, and that goes for these mega athletes who are in that corporate space as well, can you fight and be an owner at the same time? Is Nike, and let's not forget, Nike still offers police 10% discounts when they shop online. So what are we really doing here? It's one thing to support Cap, which I completely am appreciative of. It's another to support the issues and to pay attention to what this is really all about. Are you down or are you not down, or did you just make sure that one of your clients got rehabilitated in the way that he deserved? Yeah. I mean, there's value in that, but still, there's two issues.
Yeah, I had forgotten about the 10% discount for the police. Like, I had totally forgotten about that. And that's an interesting one, too, because it's not even like that's something that's, like, widely publicized. They just do it.
They just do it.
So
no
to speak.
Pun intended.
So to speak. Right? All right. Now, let me ask you. So we are on Friday Night Lights. This is what we've been doing for this summer. And one thing that's interesting is we talked about this a little earlier. This is not one of your favorites.
It's not one of my favorites, but it is one of your favorites. And I actually had questions for you on this. And I love it because, you know, being where you're from and being where I'm from, this is like one of the great sort of moments where where you do get that sort of national, regional divide. I'm from Massachusetts. The last thing we care about is Friday Night Lights. High school football means virtually nothing here. high school football means everything down there. And I was thinking when I was reading this book and preparing for this, because I hadn't read this book in years, and I'm glad you chose it because of where we are today, but I was wondering why this was one of your favorites. I think I kind of know the answer, but I wanted to hear it from you.
You know what? I've always wondered, though, with the mainstream affection that exists for Friday Night Lights, I don't feel like they are into it for the same reason that I am into it. So part of it for me is, yes, like I understand the lure of high school football and what it means. But I don't think I fully, like, really understood it until I read this book when I was, like, 19 years old. Because I am at once, like, from a city. I grew up, like, right on the, like, north side fringes of Houston, but I went to school in a town with 1,500 people. So, like, I wasn't really, like, bathed in the high school football stuff the same way, because I didn't have no ride home after the games from the little towns that they were going to play at. I didn't have a license, right? So I couldn't, like, do it in that way. But I found that Bissinger almost unwittingly stumbled into a great analysis of race and class in America with high school football as kind of being the lens on it. So it's not like I have like all these heroes of the book that I love as much as I thought he did a great job of explaining, for example, the willingness that people have to tolerate black folks who serve them without having any respect for their decency or their humanity. And he managed to get these people to express these things in really raw, unvarnished ways that made it impossible for people to like walk away from it and come up with some excuse as to what was going on.
Absolutely. And absolutely. And if you read, the book now through the lens of 2018, there are a couple of lies that are exposed, and one of the lies that's exposed is that anything that's happening right now wasn't happening before. This has been a growth. I mean, you were an outgrowth of the 80s, and when you look at where we are, when you're looking at where we are in terms of how we view the geopolitics of oil and war, if you look at the geopolitics of, or even just the national politics of race and class, and when you look at all of these things, even if you look at it from a stick to sports standpoint, that all the roots of what we're talking about in terms of American divides are taking place in this book, and this is the mid 80s.
Yeah, and see, like, so that was all the stuff that did it for me. Really, was just the idea that no, I think we had like. This explains it. Like the notion of identity in sports teams and football teams do this really differently than any other sport in this country, where personal identity is tied to the football team. And it's not just that they want to win, but they want to win a certain way. They want it to look like them. That this is what they live and feel. And so also for me being from Texas, I understand that Texas being so big, like I look at Texas almost in a lot of ways like an African nation in the sense that these lines these lines were thrown down arbitrarily. And so like you may look at Cameroon and you're like, okay, all those people are from Cameroon. No. There's some from here, there's some from here, there's some from here, there's some from here. They're nations within nations. And so like these high school football teams are the pro sports teams for these nations within the nations.
That's right. And that's one of the reasons why I was always so reluctant. I don't necessarily get into the regional divide on this because I'm not from down there and I'm not from the South at all. And when you talk about this notion of working and performing for without being respected by, that's how I view football in general, especially college football, which is one of the reasons why I don't watch college football very much. It's that attitude. You are here to perform for us, and that performance, one, has to be good, if not great, and all of your behaviors are going to be viewed through this certain lens when we don't even view our own behavior through that lens. I mean, the depravity I think the politics of Chapter 9 were fascinating. The politics of it in terms of, I'm reading this and I'm going, yeah, this is 2016, yeah, this is 2017, yeah, this is now, in terms of the different ways that you could feel those divisions. But the depravity in terms of capitalism of Chapter 12, and I'm sorry, Chapter 11, especially when you're talking about the growth and the line in there when they're talking about the crash in the oil business. And the conversation, all we need all it's going to take is a war in the Middle East and everything changes. I'm like, yeah. And you're about to get two of them, considering that line in that book is pre-Gulf One. And we ended up having two Gulf Wars, and oil was at the center of both of them.
Yeah, no, and that was when they talk, and throughout the book, the idea of like the power of oil, right? Like when oil's up, everything is big over there. This also is an interesting tie. I know you being from one of them cold weather places, you remember this, the boom of like the Edmonton Oilers in the 1980s?
Absolutely.
It's really, you know, Oilers, right? Like
they're actually the oil.
Right. It's really tied to that.
The Oilers.
The Oiler thing stopped cracking and they had to trade Wayne Gretzky.
That's right.
You know, like these things, like the way they tie into sports in that way is so much. And so like, you know, chapter 9 was like really expressly about politics with, to me, the election, like the most forgotten, incredibly important election of all time, right? 1988, where if Dukakis had won it.
The first year I voted.
And also we forget if Dukakis had won, a whole lot of people would have gone to jail.
That's right.
For Ron Contra. And it just didn't happen in part because Michael Dukakis did not have to go understand and talk to these quote unquote regular people, for lack of a better term, right? Which has been a political theme ever since, it should be noted.
It sure has. And the other piece of that too, when you look at the implications of that election, were once again the entire blueprint of electoral politics and racial politics. Really, it didn't start there, because obviously you can go to Goldwater. You can go further back than that. You can go to Goldwater. You can go to even Wallace running for president in 68. There's all kinds of different, and of course Nixon in two elections. But in the television age, that Willie Horton is right there. That's 1988. That is the blueprint for scaring white America. Whether you're doing it with ballplayers today, you did it with Willie Horton back then, you did it with welfare queens earlier. But the entire way that elections are sold and the way that you're strategizing that 1988 election is, and you're right, it's underrated and it's overlooked because it turned out to be a blowout, but it wasn't always a blowout.
No, it wasn't. It looked like the dude was going to win. Like, the previous administration was coming off of a colossal scandal, right? Like, a scandal that dwarfs what Gore was dealing with coming off of the Monica Lewinsky situation. And no, it wasn't that. And then Dukakis, like, I do remember seeing him, and, you know, growing up in Texas as this happened, and just being like, even at, like, 7, 8 years old, I was like, you didn't really understand how to talk to these folks. They are not charged up at all about this.
No, and he's also from my state. He was the governor.
Yep.
In Massachusetts. And so, and what was funny about that is up here, he was considered, what's the best way to say it, you know, the better candidate, the obvious candidate, although everyone sort of knew that you weren't sure if that East Coast game was going to play once you left the 617 area code. But at the same time, the big deal up here was the fact that Jesse Jackson had run for president, had gotten 7 million votes, and they were sort of, you know, they being the Dukakis campaign, still weren't particularly interested in cultivating black votes. They just assumed, like the Democrats always assume, that the black people will just show up and we don't really have to deal with them at all. And so it's funny that reading that chapter gave you sort of a Texas viewpoint of Dukakis when I had one of my own, because I remember it.
And it's also interesting, too, is Christina makes this point, one of our listeners makes this point about Dukakis, that they thought that the Pledge of Allegiance and, like, gun control stuff were just a fad and that they would die out. And here we stand 30 years later.
Well, that's that arrogance. And that is that arrogance. That is that, and that's the, you know, that's that thing that New Englanders always get accused of, that we will explain to you what's going on without listening to you, and then get caught, you know, get caught in our own arrogance. Because, you know, that you know, East Coasters always think that they, you know, that they control everything. Usually find out the hard way that they don't.
Yeah, well, also, Bush hit him with you're soft on crime, which means we're tough on crime. And I wondered if Dukakis and those people fully understood at that time what that meant. They were not talking about crime.
They weren't talking about crime. And climbing into a tank a week before the election was not going to change people's minds.
No. I forgot he got in that tank.
A little 5'7" man got into a tank and never served in his life, was in a tank thinking that was going to change the election.
People don't even think he could reach the pedals. But
however, what's funny about that, though, is that somebody else who never quite served got to hop on an aircraft carrier and say mission accomplished. So it all depends on who you are.
Yeah, I tell you this though, you might want to wait till you win something. Maybe that was the moral of the story, right? Like,
exactly.
Like, I don't think mission accomplished plays the same way if he jumps in and says off to the mission. Like that one, then all of a sudden he's getting a little bit of a different look. Now the next chapter, all the Booby Miles stuff is flat out heartbreak, right? Just every single bit of it is flat out heartbreak.
It's total heartbreak. And it reminded me of the documentary Hoop Dreams. I was like, here we go. And I'm sitting there looking at this, and I think you can always tell a great book when you're not looking at something visual. You're looking at words on a page, and still you're looking away from the page. It's like covering your eyes in a horror movie. At least you're watching somebody get gored on the screen. Here you're actually looking at a book with a binder and a spine and paragraphs, and you're still looking away because of what's on the page. And you think about it in so many different ways. I mean, I'm thinking about it in terms of, one, this obsession is so ridiculous, but two, you also think about it from the standpoint that there's no way out. There's no way around it when you're thinking about identity, and then you think about sports, and it's the part about sports that, you know, you're not going to be the same guy when you get hurt, and life goes on, and all of these different things that we talk about when it happens to somebody else, but what about when it's happening to you? It's all being taken away from you. And it was really tough to read.
Yeah, and, you know, and when you start hearing the people really be honest about how they feel about them.
Exactly. Then you find out, oh, this is what you feel when I can't run. And especially when the coach is talking about, and also you talk about unwitting. And I have to admit, as a reader, and it's hard being an author and a reader, but I think I've always done this. I think when you're an author and a reader, just as you, and as a writer and a reader, most of the times when we read, there's a little tiny piece of us that's critiquing the sentences, like that's a damn good sentence, or I would have written it differently. But even before I was a writer and an author, I would always read white authors to see if they could be trusted. I would read their paragraphs to see how are they describing us? How do they feel about us? What are they emphasizing? And what are they not emphasizing? And the one thing about this is that I still don't know if Buzz Bissinger was being unwitting or if he was like, yeah, I think I know, I'm tapping into something here because this is the real. And I think he does a really great job as a reporter to not let you know. I'm not going to say he's completely objective because nobody is in terms of what they choose to emphasize. But when you read those paragraphs, you're on your own to make your conclusion about how the writer feels about those sentences he's writing. And the subtle and not so subtle racism in there, when you listen to how they talk about his game, you know, how little respect they have when you're dancing in the holes and not just plowing through. In other words, it's like you would look at even someone like Barry Sanders and still feel that there was something black and disreputable about his ability to like run through the hole instead of just being John Riggins and being a real man. I'm like, well, wait a minute, what you're really talking about is black style, but you're also talking about the fact that this kid is injured, and have a little bit of compassion, please.
Yeah, like I've always felt, and I've talked to him briefly once, you know, about the book, but I felt like he knew exactly what it was that he was watching once he got there. Because, you know, the people in that town really hated him after it happened because he put their racism on Front Street in the way that he did. Like, he got down there and was like, oh, my God, really? Like, you're just going to talk to me like this?
Exactly. Well, because they – it's normal. And that is the piece of it. It's like when – if you ever read Wise Guy, the Nick Pileggi book, which became the movie Goodfellas. There's a great sentence in there when they're talking to the FBI guy, because let's not forget, it's not really in the movie. It's not really in Goodfellas. There's one scene when Henry Hill walks into the bar and they're all watching basketball. And that's, you know, those Goodfellas, those are the guys, those gangsters were the ones with the Boston College point shaving scandal, with Ernie Cobb and those guys, and Rick Hoonson. And so the Henry Hill's gang, those were the ones who were fixing those games, those Big East games.
Right.
And there's a paragraph in Pileggi's book where the FBI guy says, while interviewing Henry Hill, Henry was so glib he didn't even realize the things he was saying were crimes. You know, in other words, it's like there were just so many things that he just took for granted that he didn't even realize were felonies. So when you're listening to Buzz you're watching him interview these people and you're reading their quotes, they probably don't even realize that he's putting them on blast because they've always been. It's just natural for them to talk that way. It's how it is.
Now, chapters 11 and 12 is really Midland and Odessa, and then talking about, like, the game between Midland Lee and Odessa Permian, which, like, even me in Houston, and that's a whole world away from there, we knew about what that game was. What was your read on that?
Well, I thought what I thought was interesting was that I don't know Texas particularly well. I mean, look, I'm a baseball guy, so I never covered college football, so I've never been to, like, College Station, and I don't know where all these places are. I don't know, you know, the different regions. So between Midland and Odessa, I've been to Houston, I've been to Dallas, I've been to Austin once. That's it. So I don't know where anything really. I've never been to San Antonio, so I need to look at a map to figure out where this is. I enjoyed it though because the one thing that came clear in the geography of it really didn't distract me from it too much was the class element.
Yes.
You put that line down and you could see who made it, who didn't make it, you know, what class identity characteristics were applied to Odessa against which ones were applied to Midland. And then, of course, the money. And then, of course, you remember you're dealing with the boom of the 80s as well. So people, it's like I used to say when I lived in California, the difference between New York and California, even if the money is exactly the same, is that people in California drive their money. You know how much money people have when you hop on the freeway. There are people in California who have like five roommates and they drive a BMW. So in reading that chapter, it was the fact, I mean, how much Midland was wearing its money and how that, you know, how those attitudes about class and respectability sort of translated to football. I thought it was kind of fascinating.
And see, and this is why, that's the stuff that guided for me about this book. It was nothing really about the narrative, right? Like, I could, you know, the narrative is just kind of what it is. But, like it was those observations and that thought, because you are as far removed in Boston from Midland and Odessa as I would be growing up. Like, West Texas is just somewhere else. It is another place. And so, like, hearing that, it was just like, oh, all of this makes so much more sense now. Like, I thought about the school, the rival high school that we had a little ways where the perception was that they were the ones that had the money, you know, and how that colored everything that went from there. And so when you're, like, reading the newspaper about Midland Lee and Odessa Permian playing, hey, Lee, let's not lose sight of that. But when you see read about that in the newspaper, you don't get why the beef is there. And then get in the book and I'm like, oh, God.
Exactly. Yes. Here's actually why we hate each other. And it's also universal. You can take any town, any region, any state, and you've got that dynamic in there. But what you don't have is you don't have the stakes necessarily. You don't have the type of, you don't have 30,000 people in the stands because that is a true identity. One of the things about sports that's always interested me is the places where I've lived in terms of Massachusetts, especially Pennsylvania, going to college, California, San Francisco, all of those places have one element in common, and that is you may be a hardcore sports fan. You may be deep into Celtics, Sixers, and 49ers, Cowboys, and whatever else, and Raiders, A's against Giants and 49ers, whatever it is. However, in those areas, there is an entire universe of people who do not care. And that's not what you get when you read this. You try to find somebody that doesn't care about this in that region. And I think that's the part that gives it the sort of the power where you look at this. And you have to take a little bit of a step back, especially because you're reading it with a remove of 30 years. And you're also reading it at a remove of me being 30 years older than being, you know, at that time. And, you know, in 1988, I was, 19 years old. And so you're reading this, and the first time I read this book was, I think, in the early 90s, and I looked at it for the sports. I wasn't really that into it for the rest of it. Now, today, as an adult, being where we are, and after all the road that we've traveled, you're looking at this, and you can see the subtext of those rivalries and the universal nature of those rivalries. And I think the other thing, too, that really struck me about it was the rivalry and the machismo that's underneath it. You know, people will always find a way to rub something in your face, whether it's football, whether it's money, whether it's who's got oil wells and who doesn't. it just struck me once again that when you're in those trenches, you know, we're not just talking about field, you know, field position.
Yeah, and now you see the big part of why I picked this book, because these movies and TV shows is not what the story is.
No, not at all. And I think what's funny, do you remember, by the way, I think when I first got to ESPN in 07.
Yeah.
You were there.
Yeah, I was there. Briefly.
Were you at the Storytellers Conference in Jersey?
No, they didn't invite me to any of the good stuff.
The reason why I bring it up is because at that crazy Storytellers Conference, when ESPN essentially like bought the town for the weekend, and you know, we owned the beach for like 3 days, the featured keynote speaker was the director of the TV show, Friday Night Lights. And the star quarterback, who I think got paralyzed, I think, in the first episode of the first season, I didn't watch it. They put season one in our swag bag, and I never watched it. I gave it away to a friend of mine who loved the TV show, so I've never seen it. So my connection is with the book and not the TV show.
Yeah, we're in the same boat there. But, hey, man, I appreciate you taking the time to go back and check it out. That is my man, Howard Bryant. Check him at ESPN, the magazine. My man, I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
All right, we are wrapping up the Right Time Book Club. Thanks to everyone who has joined us through the summer and into now in reading the book. The book, for those of you who want to catch up late, is Friday Night Lights by Buzz Bissinger. And Buzz has been kind enough to join us here on the Right Time today to talk about the book. I have largely said to people that this is as strong a study as I've seen of race in America, really, because I think it came to an eye level that was important for people to grasp, because this wasn't in these big macro terms. It was like, these are the little things that you see every day. And I imagine, was that the book that you thought that you were going to write once you got to Odessa?
Well, yeah, when you do something like this, look, Bunny, you're exactly right. And this is why the book had impact. If this was simply a nostalgic look at high school football, which is written about, you know, 100 times, it would not have had impact. It was an eye-level view of racism. It was specific racism directed against a single black player who was treated as an animal. He was treated as a football animal. He was called the N-word. Once he got hurt, they had no use for him. That is rife in the book, as is the attitude of the town. And that's why the book took off the way it did. That's why the book is so close to 2 million copies. And that's why the book sells today. And there are other issues. There are other sociological issues that are expressed, including the fact that these kids are used up at 17, the ridiculous misplaced priorities, the amount of money that is spent on game film for the books for the English department, flying, you know, on charter jets to away games. Get serious.
I thought, and I grew up in Texas, I grew up in more of the eastern part of the state. So like when I read about things like Odessa and Midland, for me, it's almost like reading about a different country. But I thought.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Houston.
Oh, in Houston. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, West Texas is way far away for us.
Yeah, way far away. Although Houston had some, you know, great teams. Houston Yates was one hell of a team. And I guess 1987 or 86, they clocked Odessa Permian in the state finals. They had a great team.
Yeah, and see, Yates is interesting because it's like in the Houston Independent School District, so race is a different variable because everybody there is black. Like everybody that's in the school. What was interesting so much to me about Odessa was not just how the football team and how race played with that, but like how that dictated the way the school district lines were drawn and everything else, because the one value they seemed to have for black people was for football.
That's exactly right. I mean, they were perceived, and they won't admit it, and I hope it's changed. Blacks were perceived in Odessa as really only being good in terms of their ability to play high school football, and that's why the lines were drawn in such a way that there was a kind of housing project on the south side of Odessa below the railroad tracks that was gerrymandered in, so Permian would get all the great, you know, black football players. It was apparent. You know, this is how they thought they could win, and there were a lot of athletes who were great African Americans. Everything in that town revolved around, you know, that football team, the fandom, the emphasis on it, the racism, you know, all of it. Everything justified the means. You know, kids playing hurt. Brian Chavis plays with a fractured bone in his ankle, and they purposely don't x-ray it because they know if they x-ray it and they find it, they find the chip, he can't play. You know, kids getting, not kids, you remember Brett Hagan?
Right.
I was a really good linebacker at Texas and played in the pros for a while. I mean, he got shot up with painkillers so many times that he developed a hole in his hip, that it that had to be, the dead skin had to be cut off every week for a year. I think people read the book, yes. Were they reminded of their high school experience? Of course. Did they identify with certain players, you know, whether it was Booby, whether it was Mike Winchell, whether it was Brian Chavez? Of course, but it was the hair-raising look at a team in West Texas that, made this book take off.
Now, one thing about what you mentioned there, especially with like the shooting up with painkillers and everything else, is the time horizon I found to be interesting. Just the idea, and I wonder what your initial perception was when you started working on the book, the idea that we were looking at high schoolers and saying, this is as good as it's going to get. Like, that was never my reality growing up, and I never would have thought it would be that for anybody else. But that seemed to be so clear for people there, is that, like, max out the glory of being a high school football champion.
Well, you know, look, it's only when you get in this situation that you see what you see. I mean, this was, you know, this was open-ended. You know, people in Odessa obviously objected to the portrayal of Booby Miles and racism, but, you know, I didn't create that. That's what unfolded. But in a place like Odessa, you were not encouraged to go on to college. They didn't care about college. When Brian Chavez wanted to go to Harvard, and Harvard asked for some game tapes, the coach, who was the most precise person I ever met, sent the wrong game tapes. He sent tapes of games that he was never in. They didn't care about college. They didn't care about these kids getting ahead. They cared about one thing, winning for that season. And when you were done, you were done. And when you play in front of 15,000 to 20,000 people, and when you fly to an away game by charter jet, this becomes the highlight of your life. Nothing's going to be the same. You know, they were not big. So they really had very little potential, you know, in D1. I mean, some went, but most did not. So they get Division III schools, and they're playing football, and you know, they have one-tenth of the crowd and one-tenth of the attention. And this is the danger, that when you're 17, 18 years old, you're 19, and you're nobody. No one cares.
So, like, in your experience, or I don't know how much touch that you were able to keep with the protagonists of the story, but for them, the ones that you were in touch with, what did life turn into for them, and how did they seem to feel about it?
Well, Booby Miles just got out of prison. I visited him in prison. He's out. You know, we keep in touch. I've given him, this says nothing about me. Who cares? You know, I've tried to give him significant financial help. To get out of the pit. He really understands now what happened. I believe it when he says, you know, you got to get an education. When he was at Permian, he was given the answers to the quiz the day before so he could be academically eligible. He's had a lousy life. Now, who knows what would have happened, but when you're treated as dysfunctional in high school, when you're treated as a football animal, when no one cares about you academically, you're not going to have a good road ahead. You're not. And for Booby has been haunted forever by what he could have been. And frankly, you get the exposure of the book, but then you get the exposure of the film. And it's this crazy situation where he goes to the mall and he's recognized and he doesn't have a job. And I wasn't surprised. It was tragic, but I wasn't surprised he ended up in prison because that was the direction he was headed in. And I hope to God that he's found himself. I think he has found a good woman who takes care of him, and he seems pretty centered. But, you know, the way he was treated in high school, he didn't have a chance. Now, you know, Brian Chavez went to Harvard. He's returned to Odessa. He's a prominent attorney in town. Mike Winchell, the quarterback, was a very, very quiet private life outside of Fort Worth and plays a lot of good golf. Dom Billingsley actually did the best of all of them, which was surprising because he was the Don Juan. So he's doing okay, but he recently went through a divorce. You know, Jarrett McDougal, you see it in his eyes, and I love Jarrett. He misses it so much. You know, it just crushes you. It just crushes you to see it.
Were you surprised that Chavez came back to Odessa? Because I find that people tend to leave, like when they leave, especially go somewhere for Harvard, it's to get away and it's not to come back.
I agree. I was surprised, and I've thought about it. And, you know, look, you came from Houston, which is a big city. You know, you see a lot more of the world, whatever you see, when you walk out the door. These kids, I believe, had a sense of inferiority coming from a place like Odessa. You know, we're out there in the middle of West Texas. Everyone thinks we're a bunch of ticks. And it was very obviously very, very hard for them to leave the womb of Odessa. And that was true of Brian. Now, he's very, very close to his family. And that was one reason. And his father tragically, you know, went to prison on some tax issues. And then I think it became incumbent on Brian to keep the firm alive. And his father, which is amazing, retook the bar, his past, and is one of the greatest guys I've ever met. But it was, you know, when Mike Winter was a senior, Mike was really smart. And Mike was curious about the world. And I just urged him to, you know, he had a chance to go to Davidson, which would have been great for him. And he could have played football. I just couldn't get him to do it. I could not get him to leave the borders of Texas. And, you know, that's look. At the end of the day, it was their lives. And I think they have found comfort in the lives that they had. You could have probably argued, you know, you never should have gotten involved in the first place. When I saw how smart Brian was and how good he was in football, forget football, he was a really bright kid. I did get involved. And my wife, who went to Harvard, got involved to encourage him to apply. And he got in. But he did go back. I thought he might be a politician or do something completely different.
Well, one place that this book helped me was where I grew up in Houston, but I went to school in a little town called Waller, which had 1,500 people at the time. And I'd never really grasped kind of the difference between my experience growing up, like my parents are college professors and stuff like that, versus the people in this town, because the town wasn't far. Like, I didn't think of it as being a different place. And then I go back for like a 20-year reunion, and I was surprised by how many people, smart or otherwise, were still there. And like, to me, it's like, yo, the city's right there. It's like 20 minutes away. And when you talk about those walls, this helped me understand the people that I went to school with a lot better, especially with football and identity issues, because I just didn't think of anything that way. But for so many of them, this was as good as it was going to get.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, you've seen it. Your parents were college professors. I assume that I assume, you know, Bomani, you're going on to college. You ain't going to stay in high school and become a you know, high school football stud, and it has been. And you saw it. And look, I think there were some smart kids at Permian, and there are some smart kids at Permian who have gone on and done interesting things. But a wall does build. It becomes very, very insulating. And, you know, but look, you've been to West Texas. You see what it looks like. You know a place is bad when other people in Texas make fun of it. And Odessa was always sort of, you know, the heel of the state. And the one thing they had going for them was they did have, great, great football players.
Now, is there anything for you when you look back on the book that you might even understand better now versus about 30 years ago from when you wrote it?
You know, it's a good question. It's an interesting question. I haven't been asked that. When I wrote the book, I knew that people in Odessa would not like it. I didn't do it. There were people there I liked. I didn't do it to hurt them. But, you know, as you're writing it and as you sort of put it on paper and as you see the way that Boobie Miles was treated, as you begin to think about an 18-year-old kid, you know, compared to a horse that is turned up lame and then people laughing about it, you know, this became hair-raising. I think what I've learned, though, is, you know, people do what they're supposed to do, and it isn't fair to me to have a certain judgment that you should have done this, you should have done that. When I did the 25th anniversary, I saw all the kids again. And I should mention Ivy Christian, who's a trucker and has done great, has a very stable family and a beautiful kid. They lived the lives they wanted to lead, and they lived the lives that they should lead, and I shouldn't put my own imprint. Because, you know, they seem satisfied. There might be sadness. You can see in their eyes that some of them really miss, playing in front of 20,000 people. But, you know, this is life, and you do, I think, what you're made to do, or you're supposed to do. Back to Odessa. Frankly, no one cares about me now because of the film, not really the TV show. They don't care about that. And I have friends there. Brian Chavez is a friend for life. Brian Chavez's dad, Tony, is a friend for life. Boobie will always be in my life. He could be a pain in the neck because he can get emotional and volatile, but he's in my life forever. And all those kids are. You know, the coach, Gary Gaines, there was friction between he and I, but I understand he is early Alzheimer's, and that kills me. That just kills me. He was a good guy. You know, he did things that were wrong, I felt, but it kills me for him to have early Alzheimer's at his age, which, you know, basically in his late 60s. So it's always going to be a part of my life, and I'm, you know, Odessa's had 30 years to pick at this book and find fault and this and that. And, you know, truth is subjective, as we all know, and they've never found a single thing. They may not like the emphasis. They keep claiming we're not racist. We don't use the N-word, and they did a school poll to prove that. And you know what, Pamani? A third of the kids said they'd use the N-word at least once a week or once a month. A third of the kids in high school. So, you know, they shot themselves in their own foot. But I, you know, the only thing I regret is it's the only thing I'm known for. And that becomes hard, you know. And I sometimes think, Jesus, I became the high school equivalent of a literary equivalent of a quarterback. And I've done a lot of things, other things in my life that I'm proud of. But, you know, nothing will ever reach, you know, the heights of Friday Night Lights.
I always find it interesting when you talk about the idea that people like only know you for this, because I think a lot of people, maybe myself included, I would love to be known for doing something like this. Like, my father is the founding president of the National Conference of Black Political Scientists, and like W.E.B. Du Bois is his hero. Like, that is cool. That is his guy. And I really do look at this book as being in line with sociological studies on that level in explaining this. So what is it about people putting such a focus on this that bothers you? Is it just the idea of ignoring some of the other things that you've done?
Yeah, look, as my father said, you know, you're being a baby. You know, shut up. This is a good problem to have. And it is. But I think, you know, I wrote the book. It was the first book I wrote. I was 34 years old. I didn't really know what I was doing, except I had great passion to do this. It worked out beyond my wildest imagination. And I do think part of life, you know, is moving on and creating other goals for yourself and exceeding them. And you know, I figured out pretty early I was not ever going to exceed the success and popularity of this. And yes, at times it has depressed me. But, you know, look, as I get older, you're right. I mean, I'm lucky. I think I wrote the book in 1990. So what is it, 28 years later? And we're having a discussion about it. That's amazing. That's remarkable. And I did that. You know, I did that, and I tend to be hard on myself, but, you know, I'm proud that I did do that. It was a great idea, and I took a risk, and I moved to Odessa, and I quit my job, and I moved my twins down there, and, you know, got married, which actually was unfortunate, but, you know, I left a mark. I left the Friday Night Lights as part of the vernacular, and you know, I did leave a mark on society and, you know, racism and overemphasis in sports, and I am proud of that.
Well, one thing I want to ask you before we let you go is that this book actually talks about two high schools, and Dallas Carter is the other one. And I remember the first time I read the book, I was not familiar with the Carter story. And it was such a jarring thing to go from all the discussions about Odessa and then go into what had happened with the guys from Carter with the robbery ring in Dallas. And I always imagined the people from Odessa getting to that part and being like, see, we were right. And that, you know, you wrote what was factual.
At that point, they weren't going to articulate that to me because, you know, they would be racist. Well, everyone, you know, every team they played in the state in the playoffs, which were predominantly white teams, you know, felt that. Now, I'm not going to excuse Dallas Carter because I will never understand why these kids did what they did, except, you know, Derek Evans, who was a great high school football player. He was great. He was better than Jesse Armstead, who went on to a great career in the pros. You know, Derek Evans signed his letter of intent with Tennessee. He was in a sauna tub with all these gold chains around his neck, and it was covered by every television station. When he got stopped for speeding by a cop, the cop recognized him and said, you know, I'm going to let you go. And when you're treated that way and you go on these recruiting sprees and you're supplied with credit cards and women, you're not going to have a normal sense of the world and your responsibility, you know, within it. So I'm not going to condone what Dallas Carter did, but there was a tragedy because I interviewed Derek and I interviewed some other kids, and they were good kids. And I interviewed the parents of two of the players, and it was crushing. This was one of the finest men you would ever meet. Finest men you would ever meet. And to have two of his kids in prison was beyond crushing. And that game, too, went to the core of racism. I don't know if you remember the book when they were arguing over referees. Two had to be white. Two had to be black. Two had to be black. No cotton bowl. Too many blacks there. So, you know, anyway.
When you were writing the book and the decision was put in to add that, did you worry at all about how that part would be received, just because it would seem to be like confirmation bias for so many other people?
No. I mean, look, Did I know that the people in Odessa would not like it? You know, of course. I mean, I've been a journalist at that time for a long time. Did I have to put it in because it went right to the heart of what I had been writing about and right to the heart of how racism or race is at the root of pretty much everything we do in the world and pretty much at the root of sports? You know, I had to put it in because it did confirm many of the things I've been writing about, not just in Odessa, but kind of on a global scale, because the people of Dallas Carter were arguing right back. You know, we want black refs here. We want to play in the Cotton Bowl. We don't want to play here because, you know, it's predominantly white. I mean, race infused everything.
And they had taken a lot of the same academic shortcuts also to make sure that their players were eligible. Like, I thought that really did bring full circle that it could also sometimes be black people who are patronizing two black children and them in positions
to
fail.
That's exactly. I'm really, really glad you said it because that was true. And are they the only ones? Oh, come on. Absolutely not. I mean, Odessa is the same thing with Booby, but absolutely not. The obsession to win a state championship in Texas is just paramount. And whether you're white, you know, whether you're black, and we still see it all the time. We still see people cheating and coaches cheating, white, black, brown, or green. It doesn't matter. And, you know, what kind of lesson does it teach your kids? Well, in the case of Dallas Carter, it taught these kids to think they were invincible and could do armed robberies because the gun wasn't loaded. They weren't going to use it. But, you know, that's crazy. And they are kids. But when they're treated as gods, you know, this is what can happen. And this is what did happen.
I'll ask you one last thing about this book, just because it is maybe the most interesting Easter egg that has developed as the years have gone on. Like, what was your thought the first time you looked on television and saw Odell Beckham Jr.?
Well, you know, it kind of blew me away because I vividly remember the game that his father played. It may have been the most greatest football game I ever saw. And, you know, I remember Odell. I knew he went to LSU, and I kind of sort of kept tabs on him a little bit. And then all of a sudden, I started hearing about Odell Beckham Jr. And my God, you know, Odell Beckham Jr., when he has it together, is unbelievable. You know, it was the same thing, Jesse Armstead, who came back from a torn ACL at Miami. And my God, there he is, you know, playing linebacker for the Giants and playing it with the same aggressiveness and instinct that he played at Dallas Carter. And so it was cool to see, you know, look, it happens one time out of a thousand, but it was cool to see that some kids get ahead. And I remember Jesse being quoted when he tore his ACL as Booby Miles said, "I'm not going to be Booby Miles. I'm going to work and I'm going to overcome this." And he did. And, you know, I don't know him well at all, but I was proud of him. He worked his butt off to overcome a serious injury and become a great football player.
All right. That is Buzz Bissinger, the author of Friday Night Lights, helping us wrap up the Right Time Book Club. I thank you so much for taking the time to join us, man. I really, really appreciate it.
All right, Bamani, my pleasure. I love what you said, Easter egg. That was a great, great. I love that.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it. You enjoy your day.
All right, man. Thank you.
Yes, sir. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing twice a week. Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Also, thank you to Buzz Bissinger, the author of Friday Night Lights, and thanks to all of you who did The Right Time Book Club with us. I hope you found it enjoyable. Remember to rate us and review us. Give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think you're a hater. Talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.